Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, ballerina Misty Copeland started her dance training at the late age of 13 in an after-school program.
The first class was on a basketball court at the Boys and Girls Club, and I don't think I really got it then. I was like, what am I doing here? In my socks underneath this hoop and trying to do ballet.
Nonetheless, Copeland was soon recognized as a prodigy and rose quickly to opportunity and success. In 2015, she became the first African-American woman promoted to principal ballerina by American Ballet Theatre. Copeland's childhood was marked by fear and insecurity, so her rise toward the confident, renowned dancer she became in an art form dominated by white people is unique in many ways. Misty Copeland writes about her life and lessons learned in her books Life in Motion, An Unlikely Ballerina, and Ballerina Body. She spoke with University of Washington professor Valerie Curtis Newton at UW's Meany Hall on March 24th as part of the UW Graduate School Lecture Series, Equity and Difference, Privilege.
Good evening. My name is Valerie Curtis Newton, and I am... And I am the head of performance in the University of Washington School of Drama, where I teach acting and directing. On behalf of the graduate school here at the university, I'm happy to welcome so many of you. A university, at least a good one, is intended to be an incubator for aspiration. As faculty members, we vow to empower every student with the skills and belief that their dreams are within reach. And here at the University of Washington, we pride ourselves on being boundless, unlimited in our pursuit of knowledge, information, experiences, life. We support one another's pursuits to be free of intimidation or discouragement by difficulty, danger, or disappointment. We are undaunted. And tonight, our guest, Misty Copeland, embodies all of these characteristics. Boundless was she as she leapt through feelings of agony, hurt, desolation, hardship, and rejection. At the age of 13, she pushed herself to go out on a limb, far beyond her comfort zone. It was there that she found her calling, her place, her peace in a ballet studio. When she was only 17 years old, Debbie Allen called her a child who dances her soul and stated that she couldn't imagine Misty doing anything else. Debbie Allen called it right, didn't she? In August 2015, Misty Copeland was promoted to principal dancer for the American Ballet Theatre, making her... making her the first Black woman to achieve that distinction in the theater's 25-year history. So tonight, on this stage, I am deeply honored to welcome Misty Copeland. I told you that I wasn't going to do the Wikipedia interview because okay. People, they know who you are already. I would like to ask a question about the first moment that you met ballet. Mm-hmm. You know, what was that, and what shifted in you in that moment?
So much. I mean, okay, so we're not gonna do the Wikipedia, but I'm gonna go back a little bit.
You do you.
Okay. You know, as a child, I just lived my life in fear. One of six children growing up in a single parent home, We were just constantly in motion and on the move, and moving from this friend's house to this friend's house, and sleeping with this cousin's at this cousin's house and this aunt's house and in this motel. And I just became like this shell of a person, and I was just hiding behind my siblings. Just the thought of going to school gave me anxiety and fear. I didn't want any attention on me, and I didn't know that I even had a voice that I wanted to share with anyone. So when I was pushed into ballet, because I was pushed, I'd never heard classical music, I'd never seen ballet, I'd never seen any formal dance in any way, wasn't exposed to it growing up. That first time that I stepped into, I mean, the first class was on a basketball court at the Boys and Girls Club. And I don't think I really got it then. I was like, what am I doing here? In my socks underneath this hoop and trying to do ballet. But once I was brought into the studio that I ended up attending on full scholarship, it was the first time that it literally, like, this confidence that I'd never experienced in my life was just like, it came out. I looked in the mirror and I was like, oh, I'm beautiful here in this space. Like, I'm good at this. I'm smart at this. And it all just like clicked. It became this incredible, beautiful fantasy escape for me from what I'd only known as my life, which was a lot of chaos.
The one of the interesting threads, I think, in doing the research on you is this this balance between, or this war between, the confidence and the insecurity. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about how, especially moving up into the profession, how the insecurity shows itself, and then sort of what were the things that helped you to hold on to your confidence in the mm-hmm. face of that other stuff?
It's really difficult, as especially as a classical dancer. We have to be open and vulnerable to perform, to be a true artist. I think you have to have that side to you. And we're also, you know, we're just kind of like these blank canvases, and our ballet masters and mistresses and coaches and all of that, they're there to tell you what you're doing wrong. Like, that's how we get better. But there comes a point where I feel like it's easy to get kind of caught up in too much of that negativity, and then you become so hard on yourself and lose that confidence. For me, I feel like a lot of the insecurities started to come when I was a professional dancer, when I joined American Ballet Theatre, and my body started to change. I no longer was this ideal ballerina body, you know, and I hit puberty. Also, you know, being the only black woman in a company of 80 dancers for a decade, it just like wore on me and made me feel so insecure. But there was something that always happened when I went on stage, and it was like I always had confidence. It took me like a decade probably before I really experienced what it was to feel like nervous on stage. But it is a hard balance, and for me, it's really about like the support system that I have in my life that allows me to keep that balance.
So I want to talk about two things that come out of that. The first one is you had really great mentors at every stage. Mm-hmm. I mean, people who, in the language of our young people, they were ride or die from Misty, right? I love the story of your first set of mentors, Elizabeth and Cindy. And then also what happened when you got to ABT and they sort of made a team for mm-hmm. you. Can you talk about having those people sort of placed at the right place at the right time?
It's so vital and so important, and I don't think I even realized it because it was there. It was there for me. But it's something that I'm constantly speaking to like the youth about, and like young dancers that I mentor, like the importance of having that. Elizabeth Cantine, who is now like my godmother, but she was a teacher of mine in my public school. She's the one that pushed me to go take this ballet class. And then Cynthia was my first ballet teacher, and I lived with her for 3 years while I was trying to get caught up on all the training, starting so late.
At 13.
At 13,
so
yeah, it is. I only trained for 4 years before I became a professional, so I had a lot to do in that time. Mm-hmm. But it was, you know, these two women that were there, like, financially supporting me, you know, point shoes and all, you know, it's a very expensive art form to be a part of. And just being there for me, I think kind of rebuilding this broken girl that I don't even think my mother realized, you know, that she was raising this broken girl. You know, not having someone there to tell me I was good enough or good at something or beautiful. And I feel like they kind of filled me in that way. And then when I got to American Ballet Theater, Kevin McKenzie, who's the artistic director, has always been so incredibly supportive of me, which isn't always the case in a lot of companies, and especially being, you know, a minority and being the only one. He saw when I was kind of, you know, feeling that I was going down the wrong path, and he always told me that I had what it took to go all the way. But it's kind of like, okay, well, now what do I do? What do I do with this? And he was really great in reaching out to a really special woman in my life, Susan Fales Hill, who was on the board of directors, and she's this incredibly strong, powerful, accomplished Black woman. And it was the first time I had someone like her in my life that I was like, I'm you, like I am like you, and you are succeeding, and you are incredible. And it was the first time that I really felt like a true connection to a positive image of a Black woman that I could like touch, and it did so much for me and my confidence.
It's also sort of miraculous that Kevin recognized what you needed and knew that ABT didn't necessarily have it to give you.
Yeah, it's pretty
and to
incredible.
Reach out to get it for you.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
it was pretty powerful.
Yeah, it is powerful. It was his idea, and you know, he was like, you know, told Susan, like, take her under your wing, like, watch out for her, do what you need to do to, you know, to be there for her and set an example.
In talking about these mentors and what it is to be a Black woman dancing, I wonder also about the element of class and, you know, coming from a struggling working class family and needing these supports. As you moved into the professional ranks, is there a similar kind of divide between the people who grow up with a certain kind of privilege and the people who find the resources to get themselves there?
You know, I think something that's so incredible about art is that it brings people together and it kind of puts you on even playing fields. And so I feel like just my experience from, you know, being around professional dancers for as long as I have and being in American Ballet Theater, it's like once you get to that point, we're all the same. Mm-hmm. But during my training process, it was really difficult. To feel that you fit in and you belong, you know, and you know, the class thing. And, you know, I'm, you know, going home to the motel on the weekends and my friends are going off, you know, to ski, you know, in California somewhere in the mountains. And so it's an interesting thing to experience. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The straddling two worlds, really.
Yes, it is.
Was it hard for you?
In the beginning. Yeah. It was difficult for me to feel that I'm a part of something that's finally like, this is my home. And then, you know, and you build these bonds with these dancers that you're with every day, but then you leave the studio and then it's like, we're not really the same anymore, you know? So it's an interesting thing to experience as a child.
And then you would have the opposite side, which is you go home to a family that doesn't really understand
absolutely
the ballet life, right?
And that was hard. That was hard as well. And it was a really difficult time. And, you know, I think I was 15 years old when my family went through the whole court case situation.
You became like Entertainment Tonight TV famous.
Yeah, it's not fun.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was difficult for my family to really understand that, you know, this is normal in the athletic world and in the arts, that, you know, dancers go off at a young age and they live with, you know, coaches, or they go to boarding schools and they focus on their training. And it was so far from the world that we all knew, that it was like, no, you're taking my sister away, you're taking my daughter away. This isn't right. And it just kind of blew up into this thing.
And was there for you a longing for them as well? How did you process the letting go of that?
Right. It was really difficult to process. Like, I think culturally, most of all, you know, I went from you know, growing up in a Black home and always in a Black environment, Black neighborhoods, and now all of a sudden I'm living in the suburbs with literally a white family, and we are no longer listening to Anita Baker and Aretha Franklin. We, you know, it was such a shift culturally for me, but I feel like because I associated this family with ballet, and it was like this, it was love, and it didn't matter what color they were. And I adapted really well because I felt that genuine love from ballet and from them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Since we've talked a little bit about it, why don't we just take that question that we talked about earlier, which is, there are a lot of people who would prefer that you not actually talk about yourself as a Black ballerina.
Mm-hmm. I thought you were gonna say, what do you like to cook?
I'm gonna get there. We're gonna get there. We've got time. That's number 8 on the list.
Oh, I have so much to say about that. It's really difficult for me to, you know, because I'm in this position, and this amazing position, and have these incredible platforms to be seen, for people to look at a Black ballerina and maybe not have any knowledge of ballet and say, like, that's a ballerina. Like, that is huge. So just because I'm in this position, I can't just remove that from my title. Mm-hmm. Like, I wouldn't be me, I wouldn't be in this position if I weren't a Black woman, mm-hmm. if I weren't a Black ballerina. And so it's difficult to explain to people who have never experienced what it is to be a minority or to be Black in America. So it's hard to explain to them that that's not something you can just drop. Mm-hmm. Like, I still have to live with this. This is still me.
Backstage, we were talking about what it is to be the only one in the room, mm-hmm. and that as you progress through your career, there are different rooms, but still, very often, you're the only one mm-hmm. in the room.
Right.
Are people getting clearer? Because you're not, as I said to you earlier, you're not new. Mm-hmm. So do you encounter more understanding? Or is it still people still behind their preconceptions?
I don't know that there's more understanding. I'm not someone that's gonna say, like, oh, you know, President Obama changed, you know, the way people, you know, no one's racist anymore. Or, like, I'm here and it doesn't exist. Like, it's just not reality. And so I feel like people are familiar and comfortable with me. I don't know that they're definitely comfortable with a Black woman. So there are two other Black women that are in ABT now, and that is huge. And I try to be there to support them. But, you know, if people have questions, which some people do, that don't understand what it is to be the only one, right. Like, I will gladly answer, you know, whatever curiosity and questions they have. Like, I don't fault people for not understanding. But I think it's a dialogue that we need to keep open for people to grow and understand and to make change.
There are some people who don't understand the discussion around body type and how it essentially is code words mm-hmm. for not white.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Because when average people look at you, they see a ballerina. They don't really understand what the dividing line was. Mm-hmm. And you talked about hitting puberty a little late,
yeah.
And all of a sudden you developed a woman's body, mm-hmm. and they didn't quite know
what to do
with that.
Right. Yeah, you know, it's interesting because when I started ballet, you know, I was considered a prodigy, and I was like, oh, you know, this perfect ideal. So it was a little easier to look past my skin color, I think. So as a child, you know, it was like, oh, you have this little peanut head and a long neck and big feet and long legs. And I was like, that's ugly. And they're like, no, it's beautiful in ballet. So that's how I was like, I'm a ballerina. Like, I look like a ballerina. And then, you know, I became a professional and my body changed. And then I had big old boobs and I had thighs and like, and I was no longer, you know, that 13-year-old, perfect little ballerina body. And I feel like people started to look at me in a different way.
Did you look at you in a different way? Or was it only when people sort of made comments, brought it to your attention. On the inside, you just felt like Misty,
yes,
ballerina.
I absolutely did. And I think it's also because I didn't grow up in the ballet community and I didn't have those, like, those ideas in my head, like, I need to be thin, I need to be this. Like, it was like, I stepped into this world and I happened to be good at it and I just did it. And so I wasn't ever thinking that I needed to be anything else. Mm-hmm. But yes, it was people that brought it to my attention, being told to lose weight by ABT.
Can I ask a really personal question?
Yes.
At your heaviest, how much did you weigh?
Maybe like 108 or 109. Yeah, I mean, I'm 5'2", and
yeah.
Well, I mean, all of that to say, you know, it's something that has taken me a long time to really clearly understand that language that's being used, because I meet so many black dancers that it's like we have the same exact stories and we're told the same thing, the same words, and you know, and I'll look at a lot of them, I'm like, how can you possibly be told you don't have a dancer's body, you know? And it's like this is their way of saying it without saying it. Like, you don't have the right skin color, you don't belong here, you don't fit in, you've never been a part of this, so you don't belong here.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk a little bit more about the body. And you and I were talking backstage, and I said, one of the things that for me is so remarkable about you is that you hit these sort of, you push yourself to these levels of achievement, and then the body breaks a little bit. Right, you get into ABT and you have a severe back injury, mm-hmm. that costs you a year of dancing.
Yeah.
Then you build yourself up and you dance Firebird, and then we discover these fractures that require surgery and then this sort of coming back. How did you mentally stay tough enough, mm-hmm. to come back after what would everyone considered to be career-ending injuries, both of them,
yeah.
because you started dancing so late, mm-hmm. the perception that each of these was career-ending injuries, but you came back with a new kind of focus and fire. Mm-hmm. What was it? How did you do it?
Well, I think that dancers have an incredible emotional and mental strength. So with that, I think before I started dancing, learning to survive in any way I could as a child, I think has made me the strong person that I am when it's in these situations, like under pressure or you know, when I feel like something's gonna be taken away from me, it's like, no, I'm gonna fight for this. And I think that was just instilled in me from a child, that it was like, you know, it was just the mode I was in always. It was like, no, we're gonna make it. And watching my mom, you know, like, no, we're not gonna sleep on the street. We're gonna find a way. And I think that's just always been a part of me. you know, the most critical was definitely, you know, when I did the Firebird. And there was a different motivation at that point. You know, I had been in the company for 12 years, and I'd been a soloist for, I don't know, like six or seven years at that time. So I was 29 years old, and I was given this opportunity to do the lead in a classical ballet, and that's extremely late in a dancer's career to get an opportunity like that. You most likely will never be a principal dancer at 29 if you're not given an opportunity before then. And something had shifted at that point. I had started working with my manager, and the conversation of diversity was really starting to resonate with people. And I remember doing the Firebird in Los Angeles. I did two shows, and the audience was so diverse. It was really the first time that we saw such a diverse crowd. And I knew I was injured at that point, and I pushed through maybe half of the spring season, and then Firebird came, and it was just like, the Black community was literally coming out to see a Black woman do this for the first time at the Metropolitan Opera House with American Ballet Theatre. And it was like, I have to do this. Like, it doesn't matter if I go out there and I'm like limping. I'm like, I just gotta show up, you know? I gotta show up
and I've gotta show
this, you know, generation that's never seen this, that may never see it again. Like, show them this is possible. Show all those dancers that were never given an opportunity. Like, this is you. This is what you could have been, and you still can be through me. And so that was the motivation to getting back from that injury. It was, it felt like life or death to me.
Well, and it sounds you know? Like some of the people in A Ballerina's Tale, the documentary that Nelson George did, one of your best friends says that, you know, you really cleaned up your act as a dancer when you discovered this higher calling, mm-hmm. that it made, that everything changed.
Yeah. And it was a different purpose and a different responsibility. It wasn't so singular and almost selfish feeling. Not that we're selfish as dancers, but, you know, a lot of it is, you know, we spend so much time working on ourselves and doing this for ourselves, even though we give so much of ourselves on the stage night after night. It's still like a very singular thing to experience. And I guess I didn't have that same motivation in that I had when I was 13 years old, when, you know, you're being celebrated. Now it was like, you're the oddball out, you're fat in our eyes, and like, where do you belong? And so it definitely sparked something different in me when it was like, you can help to change what ballet is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You did an interview with former President Barack Obama. And one of the questions, you said, when you have all of these expectations and goals to reach this point that 1% get to, you know, what do you do when you get there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I asked him that. Yeah. What do you do?
So I'm asking you,
okay.
You know, you're in that place of being the, having done all the work to be the 1%, mm-hmm. to be in the 1%.
Yeah.
What does it feel like to you, and how are you navigating it?
Yeah, I have my like ups and downs, and I think as dancers we're very critical of ourselves, and I feel like it's a different responsibility and a different pressure. It's such an honor, and I think that when I first was promoted, it took me like a year to accept it. You know, I was at a point where it was like, I'm doing Romeo and Juliet, I'm doing Swan Lake, I'm doing Firebird, this is incredible. It doesn't matter if I'm a principal dancer or not. Like, I'm doing what I've always wanted to do. I mean, I understood what that title meant for so many. So, you know, once I got there, it was like, am I as good as, you know, all these incredible dancers that have come before me at American Ballet Theatre, you know?
The title of principal dancer is a kind of validation.
It's a validation. But I mean, as a Black dancer, I mean, I understood what that title meant for me to have it. But once I got there, yeah, it was interesting to just, started to have these insecurities again. It was like, where is this coming from? And, you know, you start to think of, you know, Mikhail Baryshnikov and Gelsey Kirkland and, you know, all of these incredible dancers that have come through ABT, and you're like, am I really, like, there? And, you know, I think that it's about just accepting your journey and your path and not comparing it to anyone else's. And that's just kind of where I'm at right now, is that I'm just trying to do me and not get caught up in, there's always going to be negativity and things I read and I try not to read, and it's difficult, and I just have to, you know, believe in myself, go up there and do my best every performance.
You're It's slowed a little, but not a lot, because this new book gins it back up again. But for maybe 18 months, it was all Misty Copeland all the time.
Oh.
Under Armour, the New York Times, all of those things, and a kind of celebrity gets attached.
Yeah.
How do you? What is the? What is that face? And how do you navigate what it is to be the celebrity, not just the black ballerina, but the celebrity Misty Copeland dancer?
I hate that word so much. I do. Like, I just, it's amazing to be able to, like, represent this art form that has given me everything. It's given me my life, and I'm so grateful for it. And I think it diminishes it when you put those words on it, you know, being famous or celebrity, because dancers are so much more, first of all. And to single me out, like, I understand why I'm in this position and why I'm getting this attention. It's a big deal, you know, to be an African American and make it to this level. But I just feel like I want to represent all dancers in a really positive way, and for it not to be about me, for it to be about bringing ballet with me on these platforms. And so it's difficult when I hear that. Like, I don't want to be thought of as a Kim Kardashian. Like, I don't want to be attached to that. I have so much respect for my art form and for dancers, and so that's what I want my legacy to be.
Can you, just since we're here, can you share with this audience what a typical day for Misty Copeland is? You talk about, you know, not being Kim Kardashian. I think that when people understand what it is to get through the week, you know, in season,
right?
You know, that's a big thing.
Yeah, it's a ton of work. And so let's see, when I'm in season with ABT, like, this is an off week for me, so I can do these things. But when I'm in season, I'm in ballet class at 10:15, goes until 11:45. I'm in rehearsal from noon until 7, 5 days a week. Sometimes no break at all in between. And so I get Sundays and Mondays off, and that's usually when I'm doing, like, photo shoots and filming commercials and doing interviews and book events. And then if I have, like, a week off, then I'll... Right now I'm on a book tour, so I'm in a different city, like, state every day, doing events and things. But, you know, it's incredible that I have these opportunities, and I want to take advantage of them while I can. And again, like, it's amazing to be able to have an Under Armour deal as a dancer. Like, I want that to be the new norm. Mm-hmm. Like, why aren't dancers getting these opportunities that athletes are? We work harder.
So shall we talk about this book?
Oh, okay.
Ballet Body is Misty's new book, and it is a combination of health, fitness, and food.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you talk about what the seed was like? Did you just wake up one day and said, "Ha,
all right, Valerie Mabati"? No. There were so many things. Throughout the course of my career, I've been asked a lot of the same questions. What do you eat? What do you do to cross train outside of ballet? Like, how do you stay mentally strong and prepared, emotionally present? So it made sense just to do something like this. And I think also as a dancer, like, I want to show people kind of like what it really is to be a dancer. You know, we eat. We're not anorexic. You know, we're athletes. We work really hard. We have to constantly be thinking and taking care of our bodies because it's our instrument. This is how we do what we need to do, is through our body. And so I thought, like, this is a beautiful way for people to connect to and feel that it's possible for them to do, whether they're a dancer or not. That word ballerina body, it's not, you know, like, oh, here, take this book and do this and you're going to be me or you're going to be a ballerina. But, it's has been this long journey of me creating my own version of a ballerina body. And I want women to look at this as creating their own version of a healthy body, of their own ballerina body.
When did you fall in love with cooking?
My mom did not cook at all. So, like, you know, I was eating cup of noodles and, like, you know, string beans out of a can and hot dogs. And so I had no knowledge of nutrition growing up at all and wasn't exposed to cooking, really. So when I moved to New York when I was 17, it was like, well, you better figure something out. So I kind of just taught myself. Like, I would watch the Food Network. I started buying cookbooks and I literally started teaching myself. And I fell in love with it. It became this another escape for me. When I was in the kitchen and I put on music and I felt like I was being creative, but it was very calming at the same time.
Have any of you seen Misty as a judge on Chopped Junior on Food Network?
That was so fun.
Well, I'm sort of curious about it. Like, how did they prepare you to do this?
You know,
they just throw food at you and say,
you know, I feel like I never say yes or agree to do something or be a part of something that I don't feel comfortable or I'm not passionate about. You know, with every opportunity that I have, it's not like I'm just like, oh yeah, sure, like, give me that check and I'll pretend to like this or do this. You know, that's just not what I want in my life. Like, I have very little time and it's going to be done doing something that I love doing. So when it came to, you know, I don't know how they deal with their celebrity judges on that show, because I don't know if, like, some of them probably don't cook. And they're, no, really. And so it felt very easy for me. They were just like, you know, these are the kids. This is what they're going to be making. And I was like, great. Let's taste the food. And I'll tell them what I think and, you know, not be so hard on them because they're children. But
not like a dance master.
So, yeah, it felt very easy.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite thing to cook?
One of my go-tos, just because my husband loves it, is this citrus salmon that I, like, make the marinade myself. It's like white wine vinegar, orange juice, soy sauce, brown sugar, scallions, and then you let the salmon, like, sit in that for, like, maybe 15 minutes, put it in the refrigerator, and then you take some of the remaining marinade and you, like, bring it to a simmer and let it get thick, and then you put the salmon in the broiler. And you pour it on top, and it's so good.
Thinking about the next phase for Misty Copeland, there's more dance. That's a given. But there's more dance. Are you beginning to have a vision of what life down the road might be? Are the books a thing? Or is it just you'll know it when you get to it?
I'm hoping that's what happens. Mm-hmm. I think that I will continue writing. It's been something that I've done since I was like 15 years old and really enjoyed doing it. But I will be connected to dance and involved in dance and diversity in dance forever. But I feel like it's hard for me to really be present and focused in what I'm doing and think about that. Like, I feel like I'm like, I need to just do me what's happening right now and enjoy it and be present.
There's a lot of conversation out these days about that, that centers around the word resilience. Mm-hmm. Can you talk just a little bit about your, the key to your resilience? Mm-hmm. And maybe describe a time when you sort of feel like you were maybe your most resilient self.
Okay. I feel like it just keeps coming back to the mentors. Like, I feel like that's what has shaped me and protected me and prepared me to be resilient, is having that support system and people that are there to like push away all the negativity. It's so easy these days on social media. It's so easy to just like read a comment and you know, you push aside every positive thing you see and you see that one negative thing and you're like, that's true. That's, you know, like that, yeah, it must be true. This one person I don't even know said it about me. And I think that, you know, I have an amazing husband that's there by me that's like, wake up. Like, do you even know these people? And they don't know you. And I feel like when you just have a true understanding of who you are, like who you are inside, that it allows you to like, have, you know, have all that negativity just bounce off of you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What is it about New York? We were talking about your loving New York. You're a California.
I am
born and raised,
yes.
But New York is your home. Your place.
Yeah.
What is it about the energy of that place that
I cannot imagine myself living anywhere else? Even like thinking about kids, I'm like, how are we gonna do this? Because I wanna stay in New York. it's alive. I feel like it's brought me out of my shell. It's helped to make me the woman that I am. Like, just feeling like you're a part of the people. You're not removed, you're not in a car, like you're out there, you're in it with people,
whether you like it or not. You walk the streets, take the subway?
I don't take the subway as much anymore, but I walk the streets, and even the crazies, like it just makes it New York, you know? They like, I'll have people that literally will just come up to me like they know me, and they'll put me in a headlock and be like, let's take a selfie, and I'm like, who are you? You know? But it's like, it's New York, and I don't think I would get that anywhere else.
It's probably good preparation for the kind of energy that comes now.
Absolutely.
Being a relatively famous, I won't use the C word, being relatively famous, but people, there's a kind of energy
you.
That comes.
Absolutely.
It's got to be overwhelming sometimes. Do you find yourself someone who wades into that energy, or are you,
no.
Does your shy girl come out?
Yeah. And I've always been that way. Like if I'm in a group of people and there's that one person that's like wants to be the center of attention, is loud, I literally am like, but in general, I think that I prefer to wait till I'm on stage to have the focus on me. Like, it's exhausting to me, and I'd rather just like reserve my energy for performing.
Well, and you definitely put out way more energy than we could ever possibly give to you when you're dancing. I'm wondering if in your work as a dancer, in kicking open the door to make space for others, what is it that you hope that dance does in the world as a result of being transformed by this new energy, new people?
I just feel like it can unite so many people. Like, I was sent by the president to Cuba to speak about this, like to speak about, you know, bringing different cultures together through art and through dance. And It's just an incredible opportunity, I think, especially right now, you know, what's happening in the world. And so I feel like we hold that power and responsibility to bring people together and to stop all this craziness and separation and racism. Like, and I think that we can do that as artists. And so I hope that that's what I can continue to do by being a Black ballerina.
It's beautiful. Just a follow-up on this point. Can you talk about maybe one of the experiences, the cross-cultural experiences that you had that have made a big, lasting impression? I mean, you've been all over the world, but what might be one of those times where something happened and it just lands in your spirit differently than just performing for the people?
Right. I think probably spending time in Rwanda with this incredible program that brings in these street kids, they're called. I mean, because they literally are, they live on the street, and a lot of their family, they lost to HIV. And it was just eye-opening to see, first of all, to see the way these kids are living, but to see the way they were brought into this environment and this program that's using dance. It's like the first thing they learn. A lot of these kids are between the ages of like 6 and 19 and have never been to school. They're illiterate. They don't even know how to begin to learn, let alone communicate and talk to someone. So they're starting them out with a basic dance class, like get their body moving. It gets their cognitive skills going. And then they, when they graduate to the next level, they introduce them to language. They start teaching them English. They start learning to write. They start to learn to work on a computer. And it was just like, the power of dance is so strong and incredible. And it's like, I don't want to say it out loud, but I want Trump to see this.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Misty Copeland is a principal dancer with American Ballet Theatre and the author of Life in Motion, An Unlikely Ballerina, and Ballerina Body. She spoke with University of Washington professor Valerie Curtis Newton at UW's Meany Hall on March 24th as part of the UW Graduate School Lecture Series, Equity and Difference, Privilege. Tune in again soon.